The Voice of America, this is Learning English Weekend. I'm Katie Weaver. Here with me is Marcia James. Thanks for joining the Saturday podcast today. How are you doing, Marcia?
Hi, Katie. I'm doing fine. Looking forward to today's show. I am especially interested in hearing the story on Mesa Verde National Park. I've never been there.
Well, you will certainly want to visit after exploring it with Ashley Thompson and me. The park is not just physically beautiful. It also has some of the best-preserved archaeological sites in the country.
I know there is a long and rich Native American history there. And later, we will hear a classic American story about a Native American boy. Writer Jack London published Quiche in 1904.
But first, we have a little news. The so-called Panama Papers scandal continues to create troublesome waves for officials around the world. Today, Christopher Jones Cruz reports about how one World Bank official thinks the scandal may affect the public.
Information from the newly released Panama Papers is hurting public trust, according to a top World Bank official. Sri Mulyani Indrawati is the bank's managing director. She warns the information may make everyday citizens less willing to pay taxes. She says this could reduce public money to pay for roads, schools, or other government services. Mulyani is calling on policymakers to cooperate by developing stronger laws. The information came from documents stolen from a law firm in Panama. They show how wealthy people and government leaders around the world hide money and avoid paying taxes. Sri Mulyani says the idea of unfairness damages public trust. She says it could also lower the amount of money governments collect and could hurt the economies of countries that need to grow. She says that when everyday citizens learn that their leaders and the very rich have money in foreign banks, they ask why, and they ask if there is a good reason for people to move their money overseas or whether they are hiding something. Tom Cartamone works at the research and advisory group Global Financial Integrity. He says the money sheltered in Panama represents a large part of the economy of some countries. He says that more than $1 trillion in illicit money is siphoned out of developing countries every year. This is far more than all the foreign aid and all the foreign investment that goes into these countries every year. Sri Mulyani says that for real changes, countries will have to work closely together. Without international cooperation, it is going to be very hard to actually chase this tax avoidance, she said. Mulyani notes that slower growth around the world is worsening economic pressures in many nations, especially in the 40 weakest. She says work has begun to improve conditions so that businesses create more jobs and governments can provide basic public services and rebuild social services in countries affected by conflict. She says many of these efforts involve programs to help young people learn job-related skills. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
Thanks to Christopher Jones Cruz for that report.
Now let's move on to something decidedly more fun.
The moment I've been waiting for. You and Ashley Thompson continue with our year-long series on U.S. national parks.
This week, our national parks journey across the United States takes us to southwestern Colorado. We are visiting a large U.S. national park called Mesa Verde. It was established to protect the culture of ancient Native Americans. Mesa Verde National Park is over 100 years old. In 1906, then-President Theodore Roosevelt signed a bill creating the park. Mesa Verde offers visitors a look into the lives of the ancestral Pueblo people, who lived in the area between 700 and 1,400 years ago. The national park protects almost 5,000 archaeological sites. They are some of the best preserved archaeological areas in the country.
The term Mesa Verde is Spanish for green table. Early Spanish explorers gave the name to the area. In geology, a mesa is a flat-topped highland with steep sides. Mesa Verde is not actually a mesa. It is a cuesta, a term used to describe a hill with a sharp drop on one side and a soft, gentle slope on the other. A more correct name for the national park, then, would be Cuesta Verde. The gently sloping side of Mesa Verde was important in the formation of the 600 cliff dwellings within the park. Cliff dwellings are living areas that were set up in caves, the large open areas in the side of the cliff.
Mesa Verde rises more than 540 meters above the ground. Visitors can drive to the top of the hill on a winding mountain road. In the distance are the flatlands and mountains of an area called the Four Corners. That is where the western states of Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, and Arizona meet. Some of the ruins in the Four Corners area are from the earliest people who lived there. They were hunters and gatherers, now known as basket makers. The basket makers lived in simple caves. The first evidence that ancient people had moved to Mesa Verde is from about 1,500 years ago. Those people lived in pit houses, large holes in the ground with wood and mud covering the top. In the 8th century, the early Pueblo people began building square structures of large connected rooms, or pueblos, above ground. More than 300 years later, they climbed down the canyon walls and began building cliff dwellings.
Today, visitors to Mesa Verde National Park can see some of the remains of all four kinds of settlements. Visitors are able to explore several of Mesa Verde's renowned cliff dwellings. Many of them take several hours to reach by foot. Signs along some of the paths point to trees and plants used by the ancestral Puebloan people. Visitors will also find the juniper and pinyon pine trees that make Mesa Verde green. Cliff Palace is the largest cliff dwelling in Mesa Verde and North America. It has 150 rooms. It is not easy to get to Cliff Palace. Visitors must climb down into the canyon on a narrow path with many steps. They must also climb down several ladders. But the trip is well worth the effort. Visitors can examine this beautiful structure made of stone and clay. Spruce Treehouse is the third largest cliff dwelling in Mesa Verde. It has 114 rooms. It also has 8 underground rooms called kivas. Pueblo Indian men gathered in the kivas for ceremonies. Spruce Treehouse is usually the easiest cliff dwelling to visit. The path winds down into the valley and then up to the ruins. But visitors have not been able to explore Spruce Treehouse since October of 2015, after rocks fell near the area. Park officials closed the site for safety reasons.
Mesa Verde National Park occupies 21,000 hectares of land in Montezuma County, Colorado. About 500,000 people visit the park each year. Archaeologists working in Mesa Verde have recovered many objects that the ancient Pueblo people used, including tools and jewelry. Many of the objects can be seen in the visitors' center. However, human remains or any object from a burial area may not be touched or shown. This is to respect the wishes of the modern Puebloan people who live in the area today. Mesa Verde has been recognized as a special place. The United Nations named it as one of the first World Heritage Sites in 1978. As part of the National Park Service's 100th anniversary, Mesa Verde is offering special backcountry tours. Visitors can take a long walk to Spring House, the largest unexcavated cliff dwelling in the park. The old structure is very fragile. It has 86 rooms and 7 kivas. Because some areas could break off easily, visitors cannot enter the cliff dwelling, but the area offers beautiful views. National Park Service guides also offer early morning walks to Balcony House. Balcony House is considered a medium-sized cliff dwelling. It has 40 rooms. Visitors can climb a ladder, crawl through a long and narrow passageway, and climb a steep cliff with stone steps. Then they can watch the sunrise from inside Balcony House and begin their day just as the Pueblo Indians did hundreds of years ago. Today's Pueblo Indians consider Mesa Verde a sacred place. And for visitors from around the world, it remains a place of mystery and beauty.
Okay, I'm getting my plane ticket today.
You might want to wait. It has been raining and a little cold at the park the past couple of days. I think sunny weather is expected next week at Mesa Verde.
Well, I guess I should at least wait till our show is over. Next up is Shep O'Neill to tell us the story, Quiche, by Jack London.
Quiche lived at the edge of the polar sea. He had seen 13 suns in the Eskimo way of keeping time. Among the Eskimos, the sun each winter leaves the land in darkness. And the next year, a new sun returns, so it might be warm again. The father of Quiche had been a brave man, but he had died hunting for food. Quiche was his only son. Quiche lived alone with his mother, Ikiga. One night, the village council met in the big igloo of Kloshkwan, the chief. Quiche was there with the others. He listened, then waited for silence. He said, "It is true that you give us some meat, but it is often old and tough meat and has many bones." The hunters were surprised. This was a child speaking against them. A child talking like a grown man. Quiche said, "My father, Bok, was a great hunter. It is said that Bok brought home more meat than any of the two best hunters, and that he divided the meat so that all got an equal share." "Nah, nah," the hunters cried. "Put the child out. Send him to bed. He should not talk to graybeards this way." Quiche waited until the noise stopped. "You have a wife, Ugluk," he said, "and you speak for her. My mother has no one but me, so I speak. As I say, Bok hunted greatly but is now dead. It is only fair, then, that my mother, who was his wife, and I, his son, should have meat when the tribe has meat. I, Quiche, son of Bok, have spoken." Again there was a great noise in the igloo. The council ordered Quiche to bed. It even talked of giving him no food. Quiche jumped to his feet. "Hear me," he cried. "Never shall I speak in the council igloo again. I shall go hunt meat like my father, Bok." There was much laughter when Quiche spoke of hunting. The laughter followed Quiche as he left the council meeting. The next day, Quiche started out for the shore, where the land meets the ice. Those who watched saw that he carried his bow and many arrows. Across his shoulder was his father's big hunting spear. Again, there was laughter. One day passed, then a second. On the third day, a great wind blew. There was no sign of Quiche. His mother, Ikiga, put burned seal oil on her face to show her sorrow. The women shouted at their men for letting the little boy go. The men made no answer, but got ready to search for the body of Quiche. Early next morning, Quiche walked into the village. Across his shoulders was fresh meat. "Go, you men, with dogs and sleds. Follow my footsteps. Travel for a day," he said. "There is much meat on the ice. A she-bear and her two cubs. His mother was very happy. Kish, trying to be a man, said to her, "Come, Ikiga, let us eat, and after that I shall sleep, for I am tired." There was much talk after Kish went to his igloo. The killing of a bear was dangerous, but it was three times more dangerous to kill a mother bear with cubs. The men did not believe Kish had done so, but the women pointed to the fresh meat. At last, the men agreed to go for the meat that was left, but they were not very happy. One said that even if Kish had killed the bear, he probably had not cut the meat into pieces. But when the men arrived, they found that Kish had not only killed the bear, but had also cut it into pieces, just like a grown hunter. So began the mystery of Kish. On his next trip, he killed a young bear. And on the following trip, a large male bear and its mate. Then there was talk of magic and witchcraft in the village. "He hunts with evil spirits," said one. "Maybe his father's spirit hunts with him," said another. Kish continued to bring meat to the village. Some people thought he was a great hunter. There was talk of making him chief after old Kloshkwan. They waited, hoping he would come to council meetings, but he never came. "I would like to build an igloo," Kish said one day, "but I have no time. My job is hunting, so it would be just if the men and women of the village who eat my meat build my igloo." And the igloo was built. It was even bigger than the igloo of the chief, Kloshkwan. One day, Ugluk talked to Kish. "It is said that you hunt with evil spirits, and they help you kill the bear." "Is not the meat good?" Kish answered. "Has anyone in the village yet become sick after eating it? How do you know evil spirits are with me? Or do you say it because I am a good hunter?" Ugluk had no answer. The council sat up late, talking about Kish and the meat. They decided to spy on him. On Kish's next trip, two young hunters, Bim and Bon, followed him. After 5 days, they returned. The council met to hear their story. "Brothers," Bim said, "we followed Kish, and he did not see us. The first day he came to a great bear. Kish shouted at the bear loudly. The bear saw him and became angry. It rose high on its legs and growled, but Kish walked up to it." "We saw it," Bon, the other hunter, said. "The bear began to run toward Kish. Kish ran away, but as he ran, he dropped a little round ball on the ice. The bear stopped and smelled the ball, then ate it. Kish continued to run, dropping more balls on the ice. The bear followed and ate the balls." The council members listened to every word. Bim continued the story. "The bear suddenly stood up straight and began to shout in pain." "Evil spirits," said Ugluk. "I do not know," said Bon. "I can tell only what my eyes saw." The bear grew weak. Then it sat down and pulled at its own fur with its sharp claws. Kish watched the bear that whole day. For 3 more days, Kish continued to watch the bear. It was getting weaker and weaker. Kish moved carefully up to the bear and pushed his father's spear into it. "And then?" asked Plushquan. "And then we left." That afternoon, the council talked and talked. When Kish arrived in the village, the council sent a messenger to ask him to come to the meeting. But Kish said he was tired and hungry. He said his igloo was big and could hold many people if the council wanted a meeting. Plushquan led the council to the igloo of Kish. Kish was eating, but he welcomed them. Plushquan told Kish that 2 hunters had seen him kill a bear. And then, in a serious voice to Kish, he said, "We want to know how you did it. Did you use magic and witchcraft?" Kish looked up and smiled. "No, Plushquan, I am a boy. I know nothing of magic or witchcraft. But I have found an easy way to kill the ice bear. It is headcraft, not witchcraft." "And will you tell us, O Kish?" Plushquan asked in a shaking voice. "I will tell you. It is very simple. Watch." Kish picked up a thin piece of whalebone. The ends were pointed and sharp as a knife. Kish bent the bone into a circle. Suddenly, he let the bone go, and it became straight with a sharp snap. He picked up a piece of seal meat. "So," he said, "first make a circle with a sharp, thin piece of whalebone. Put the circle of bone inside some seal meat. Put it in the snow to freeze. The bear eats the ball of meat with the circle of bone inside. When the meat gets inside the bear, the meat gets warm, and the bone goes snap. The sharp points make the bear sick. It is easy to kill then. It is simple." Ugluk said, "Oh." Plushquan said, "Ah." Each said something in his own way, and all understood. That is the story of Kish, who lived long ago on the edge of the polar sea. Because he used headcraft instead of witchcraft, he rose from the poorest igloo to be the chief in the village. And for all the years that followed, his people were happy. No one cried at night with pains of hunger.
That was Shep O'Neill with the story Kish by Jack London.
Well, it's time to say goodbye to our listeners.
I hope they join us again next week. I'm Marcia James.
And I'm Katie Weaver.